This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org. So this first section is on the practice and politics of listening and caring. So as you both write about in your book, so much of your work and so many of the questions that you're engaged in are inspired by relationships and by the care for the people that you've come to know and to write about.
Yeah, so in Kristen, you write about thinking about the socks that you see on the clothesline and the like real human people who wear those socks and who wash those socks in the Eastern Bloc. You talk about the fate of the students that you like drank wine with while having picnics after the Berlin Wall fell.
And Joao, the entirety of Vita is motivated by a curiosity, but also like a deep love and a connection with Katerina. You challenge our understandings of the role of the researcher throughout, but you also literally bury Katerina at the end. So for both of you, listening clearly acts as a form of empathy and a form of care.
So, I mean, thinking about those themes, the questions that I was really interested in hearing from you, how do those relationships and your commitments to your ethnographic interlocutors inform your listening practice and inform how you write about your subjects, inform the types of questions that you ask?
How can we foreground relationality? How can we foreground compassion when we think about ethnographic practices and the researcher's subjectivity?
Okay. Thank you so much, Aaron, Sheila, and it's a great pleasure to be here with you, Kristen, you know, to re-encounter you here in this new space and to see familiar faces and friendly faces and unknown faces to me, so look forward to getting to know you as well. So for people who might not be familiar, because you refer to Katerina, Vita, you know, and some of, at the end you will see some of the new visual work that the artist did after having read the book Vita and gotten to know somehow Katerina via the anthropologist. So Katerina was a woman in her early 30s that I met in this place called Vita, an asylum in southern Brazil, what I call a zone of social abandonment, you know, unknown, supposedly without a history, and part of my work was to get to know her, to trace, you know, her worldliness, you know, that's basically the plot of the book Vita. To your question about relationships, you know, they have to be forged, they have to be made. You cannot assume that there is a relationship in nature, and I think that's one of the biggest challenges I think we face. How do we construct relationships, right? And in the case of, and I will focus on Katerina, but of course I could talk about other ethnographic subjects that I got to know and to work with. When I first met her, she was pedaling an exercise bicycle. So she was stuck and in movement at the same time. You know? And I think that's the first image that I had of her. And I think that's something that stayed with me, this sense that people are stuck, but they still do things, right? And that's not nothing. So that's something that I think there's an unknown there. There's a contradiction there. There's an action there, even though people seem to be overdetermined, dispossessed, without any language or history, right? So there was a movement there. And she actually asked me to come close to her, and Adriana was with me, my wife Adriana, some of you know, she teaches here at Penn, Adriana Petrina. So we went, and she started to tell her story, which had a... So there was something about the various systems that she was a part of. Oh, I had a family, I had kids, I went to the hospital. So, and I say this because I think when we meet our informants, they bring a lot. They bring stuckedness, they bring desires for movement, for escapes, they bring belongings to multiple systems at the same time. She belonged to a biological system, she was getting paralyzed. She wanted to defy that. She belonged to kinship as a system. She belonged to institutions of assistance. She was disregarded of a medical system. You know, so I think, so those things, I think they play out immediately. And depending on our openness to that and our attentiveness to that, I think they become core materials out of which we start to interrogate, to ask questions. And I think what you ask about the relationships of care and compassion, I think compassion, of course, exists and we want it to exist, but it's short-lived. There must be more than compassion. And compassion or empathy tends to be unilateral. There must be more. There must be some form of reciprocity. And I think listening and return and engagement over time allows for something to unleash. And that's why I love ethnography. And I like to think of ethnography as an open system. And in terms of listening, I was thinking about this question as I was driving here. I think one can, if one gets the geared mode, right? So one is peering over the shoulders, looking for a text. That's not what I do. That's not what I think is at stake. Because I think the text is being written. The text is in production. It's in the making on both sides of the interlocution, right? But I also think it's not enough to look to be in an inquisitive mode, sociological mode. Okay, which system is this? What's your history? Because any question tends to assume an answer. And I think what ethnography and this intense listening does, it allows some elements of the meaning of the history to pop up, but it also allows for blocks, blockages, dead ends, pauses, silences, nonsense, obstruction, blocks to emerge. And that is another richness of the listening of ethnography, because that's the unknown. And that's what also drives then a return, but also drives a certain sense of the complexity of our characters beyond the text that they might be a part of or the text that we might write about them. You know, so it forces us to resist closure to a certain extent. So, but in a very practical and technological way, then how do we incorporate all that into our storytelling, right? So I think the listening also is accompanied, just like here, by technology, right? We are wired, we are taping. So somehow my listening and my engagement with Katarina and Vita was mediated by technology. Every time I entered, I was plugged, so to speak. I had the mic on, and that was agreed upon, and that made a difference. That made a huge difference, because I was able to then go home, listen, transcribe, and hear myself. You know, hear how I was guiding, how I was not allowing for a conversation to flow in a certain way, but it also allows of a sensorium to enter. The sounds, other things that in the moment of that intense presence, that was not necessarily available to me. So there is something about, you know, that technology is part of that listening. And it allows us then to return to the materials and enrich somehow, I think, our sense of what was taking place. So I will stop there, but I think those are the dimensions that I think, if I would encapsulate in a word, I think it's the difficulty of forging relationships is also the possibility of presence.
So that's hard to follow. So I was 19 when I first traveled in the Eastern Bloc. And it was completely serendipitous that I happened to be in Europe when the Berlin Wall fell. So I had grown up in the United States in the 80s, you know, with all of the awful stereotypes about people who lived under communist regimes. And so for me, the moment of real kind of penetration, and it's important that I also had a background in Model United Nations, so I knew a lot about this part of the world, like through their documents, like how they voted in the Security Council and in the General Assembly. So that first trip, I was taking a train from Istanbul to Belgrade, and we stopped in Plovdiv, which was in Bulgaria. And as we were pulling into the station, I saw laundry hanging up on somebody's balcony, and it seems so utterly obvious to me now, but I think that the sight of those socks, of like the pants that were sort of billowing in the wind, the fact that there were people who did laundry on the other side of this impenetrable intellectual space that I knew about but didn't really know about. I knew a lot of disinformation about, quite frankly. Really shocked me. And so, you know, I sort of spent that summer of 1990 in Eastern Europe, and it was really profound because I think I suddenly realized that everything that I'd known about the world was wrong. and certainly everything that I understood about the way the world was going, as in like the Cold War might end in a total nuclear annihilation, didn't happen. I had actually dropped out of college because I thought the world was like gonna end. So, and then like 2 months later, the Berlin Wall fell, and it was like, oops, I better go back to school. So it was a really profound moment. And I think when I went back to the region to start doing field work, I never forgot how ignorant I was. And unlike a lot of PhD students who I think go into the field with like preconceived notions about what they want to study and theories, I just realized that I didn't really know a lot about anything. And I think that that actually helped me a lot. I was really willing to be stupid. And I presented myself as stupid, I think, a lot of the time to my informants. Like, not stupid, but like as if I don't understand your culture. I don't understand this transition. And in the, and when I mean the transition, like the end of communism and the coming of capitalism and democracy. And I think that that was not at all intentional on my part. It was just sort of where I was intellectually. But what it did was it allowed my informants to admit that they didn't know what was going on either. It was such a moment of political and economic upheaval in Eastern Europe in the late 1990s. You know, economies had crashed, there had been hyperinflation, banking collapses. People were hungry for the first time, especially in the Balkans. There had been a war in former Yugoslavia. So I felt like the act of listening was almost an act of experiencing the process of becoming whatever Bulgaria was going to become, which was very unclear at that particular period of time. So, you know, and then I have continued to return to the region, and obviously I feel like these days I know a lot more than I did back then, but listening requires suspending your own sense of what the world is like, how it should work, because you have those notions all the time. You carry them with you. And I just think that, you know, it's, I almost feel like it's a switch. It's like the Kristen switch, where I have a vision of how everything should work, or, you know, I'm angry about corruption, or I'm angry about, like, the hospitals in Bulgaria selling chemotherapy drugs on the black market or whatever's going on. And I have to like stop and try to understand why is this happening and what does it mean to the people who are living this reality? How do they make sense of it given the changes that are going on in the world around them? So I agree. I think that it's so important to engage. Now, unlike you, I can't use, or at least back in those days, I couldn't use recording equipment because people freaked out when I put tape recorders in front of them. They didn't like that. It was too secret police-y. So I had to just listen and take notes. I think in some ways that was good because I did feel that people got became more open with me.
It's so interesting. Like after this intense listening, which creates a sense of trust, right? Because it's a sense of trust. I think it also comes to the moment of. The question, both attending to the ways questions are answered, more than just the content of what's answered. And that's also the stuff that we do both our thinking and our writing with. You know, that kind of attentiveness to the nuance of language, you know.
Oh, definitely.
Where the pauses are there, the stutterings are there. So I think there's something there, I think that one learn from psychoanalysis, you know, which I think is an important, you know, it's kind of like, it's not just as a technique, it is where it's not enough just to go for the meaning, right? You need to stay with the way things are spoken. But I think it's also interesting, the other thing the other way around holds as well. I remember when Katarina told me, I like the ways you ask questions. For me, they meant the world.
Yeah.
You know, I like the ways you ask, so the ways of the question, you know, so it kind of pluralizes the question.
Yeah.
The question is not just, is it true or false? Did you do this or that, right? So it's not judgment built into the question, but the ways of the question, I think, is a fantastic way of almost a phenomenology of what happens mm-hmm. when one stays with.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, a great example of this was I was doing an interview with a woman at the, she was a demographer at the Bulgarian Academy of Sciences. And I was asking her about demographic policy. And she sat down and started quoting statistics to me. She had a book, and it was, you know, what percentage of children died. You know, infant mortality before 45, infant mortality in 65, infant mortality in 75 and 85, maternal mortality 45, and she just really didn't answer my questions directly, and I remember getting frustrated, like thinking, okay, I'm just gonna let her go with this, and then like the percentage of women in this profession and the percentage of children in childcare, and essentially the entire conversation. So could be summed up by her telling me, communism was really good. What happened after communism wasn't so good. And I can't say that to you because you're an American, you probably have all these preconceived notions about us. So I'm just gonna sit here mm-hmm. and I'm gonna mm-hmm. tell you statistics. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's exactly the mm-hmm. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's the way of answering the question.
Mm-hmm.
So she was also, you know, I think subsequently when I went back, she understood there was more trust, mm-hmm. right? Because I had listened to her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I had just said, okay, like lots of statistics. Mm-hmm. She could have given them to me on a piece of paper, but she decided that she needed to narrate these statistics. Mm-hmm. And in the narration of those statistics was an entire story mm-hmm. about her experience and a sort of point of view that she wanted to communicate, which I think I would have missed if I had just tried to pin her down, as you say, to the particular question that I was interested in having her answer.
And I think the more one stays, not that one knows in real time, it's kind of like a constant modulation or calibration of back and forth, but I'm always pro the more one engages, the more one returns, the more one gathers materials, the more there is, the more can be potentially archived, the more can be returned to, right? And it's so interesting, like how through this process is if there are more intimate relationships, you know, of exchange, one becomes part of people's lives
yeah.
in ways that one does not only imagine is the case, right? So I'm always intrigued by that, right? So and I always like to say, okay, the subject of statistics. You know, or philosophy, they don't have a future, but our subjects, they do have a future. And many times now with all the new media, new possibilities of communication, you know, all of a sudden we are just brought back into the picture. And in the end of the unfinished book, I actually, which basically is a way of returning to the work with Katarina and Vita, but now with her children. Because a couple of years ago, out of the blue, I got an email. Katarina's daughter, who was given up for adoption, went to Vita, got my email, and reached out to me, and she said, you will remember my case. So she was part of the ethnographic story somehow. And it's a very complicated thing. She wants to be tested for the same condition, the genetic condition that Katarina had, Machado Joseph disease, which put me in this incredible situation again, you know, like once you have this knowledge, it's a lethal knowledge. Once you have a genetic mutation, you know that you will get that condition at some point. And in my mind, what I was hearing her is that she wanted an identification with the mother that she never had, right, through this test, and the test would prove that she was the daughter of Katarina Inés Gomes Moraes. But it was more to that. So even that kept surprising. You know, 2 years, a year and a half later, she emailed me, we had this conversation over the phone, she said, I want to tell you something, and I thought it was the result of the test. And she said, Then I called her, said, no, I met my brother and my sister.
Wow.
So she's recomposing the family now, what Katarina always wanted. Restart a family. And somehow to be part of that open system, it's an incredible experience. But I think sometimes when we start this, we don't know this. So the more care there is, the more return, you know, the more maybe liveliness, potentiality can be unleashed through this as well.
Maybe I just add a question.
Yes.
This unscripted in a way. I mean, this sounds like a form of love. But love as a kind of a political project, but also maybe as a critique of the typical ethnographic method. And I don't know if the question's like fully formed here, but you know, I mean, Kristen, you develop a family.
Yeah.
You have a child in Bulgaria. Like, this is not just a project of study.
Right.
Like, you develop not just a life, but a family and a future and your whole
And
changes.
I still have family and connections. And, so, you know, as goes the history of Bulgaria, as goes part of my world, right? So, I mean, it's very... I have buried two of my informants, people that I was very, very close with. And it's painful. I actually had a graduate student. I don't know if Mariana's in the audience. I can't see. Yeah, she's there. I was talking to her the other day, and mm-hmm. she asked me a question about, like, how did I emotionally deal with the fieldwork that I did for Muslim lives in Eastern Europe? I lived in a very, very poor part of Bulgaria, very, you know, deindustrializing mining town. How did you keep your mental health? And I just said, I didn't. I went back to my room and I cried a lot. Right? It was painful. And I think that, when you get emotionally involved, I mean, I completely understand why some ethnographers don't do what we do. because it's hard. Mm-hmm. You do get involved in people's lives and you do, I mean, it is very painful when you lose people. It's painful when you, like for me especially, you know, I see what's happening to people my age, you know, whose kids, the only thing they want is to get out of Bulgaria. You know, they don't want to stay there. And, you know, the continued corruption and now the rise of right-wing parties and the xenophobia against the Syrians. I mean, it's so complicated. And so it is hard. It is a form of love, and it's also a form of incredible vulnerability, I think, to kind of put yourself out there in that particular way.
Yeah. I share that, and I think this, the way you're describing it, it's moving, but it's also very potent, like intellectually, to think like that, beyond the binary, or are you trying to save the person? Or is the person, you know, or try to objectively be detached so to obtain a kind of information. I think it shatters those kinds of modes that we tend to associate with the ethical positionality of the ethnographer. And I think that confusing state is a very creative and productive to think ethically as well.
Yeah.
You know, and to shatter some of the facile denunciations of, you know, of still engaging with humans.
Yeah.
You know, I think it, in a way, it brings out this complicated moment in which you are present with, you want to sustain an anticipation, but you can also not be the rescuer.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot be the savior. But this does not mean that you can easily escape. You can no longer escape either. So that's, I think that how do you sustain that is a crucial perspective. And I think it still allows, could deprive the other from that possibility of recognition of an anticipation, even when the conditions are dire and point to an impossibility, it's a further violence.
Yeah.
That I think somehow is at the core, I think, of the dilemmas that we face in the field. And they are unresolvable.
They are
unresolvable. Go.
No, no, go ahead.
But I think that unresolvability is an important thing that makes different the kind of knowledge we produce. Mm-hmm. And it's a different philosophy, so to speak. If you look at the philosophical debates, you know, they have their own, you know, stories, their own, you know, assemblages that they create to come to certain conclusions, to, for their analytic virtuosities, you know, basically to serve them by and large. But that confusion, that vulnerability that you says is the very stuff, I would say, yeah, of philosophy in action somehow. Right.
The different sort of philosophy. Yeah, I love the the sort of serve the analytical like purposes that you go into. But I just wanted to say mm-hmm. that I was chair of the Institutional Research Board for a while at my last institution, and you know, ethnographic protocols when they go through IRB are very difficult to deal with because, of course, the you know, you have to make sure that you do no harm to the informants. But you know, there you can't give informed consent. They don't have, you know, you don't have interview protocols. All the nice, neat things that sociologists and other researchers can do. Ethnographers don't. But I remember at some point, you know, as I was reading the guidelines for ethnography, the sort of prime directive is do no harm to the subjects. But they never ask whether any harm can be done to the ethnographer, right? Like, it doesn't matter if we get harmed in the process, right? Yeah. The IRB doesn't care because of the power differential. And that's probably right. The IRB shouldn't care. But I always think that it's kind of funny because when you're any sort of relational interaction is, as you say, it's not unilateral. It's always bilateral. It's always back and forth. And I think that you can't be a savior, and sometimes you want to be a savior, or you try and you fail, or you know, you give up in frustration. I mean, all of that has implications for your own investment in the project. But I absolutely agree that it's a different sort of knowledge that comes out of that because it's not neat. It doesn't fit into good analytical boxes. The, you know, whatever fashionable theory is, you know, in vogue at the AAA this year isn't necessarily what we're feeding into. But I think that in some ways it's more tactile, it's more real, even if it's messier.
I love that.
Okay, so our second section is on plasticity and transition. You've both already been speaking to this clearly, but Joao, so much of what you write about and what you discuss in Unfinished is about the plastic potential of people, but also, of course, of power.
You also discussed this, and it's relevant, your discussion of transition, particularly in Lost in Transition. So you both describe the ways in which individuals are often unable to anticipate or imagine the future because the present seems so fixed and totalizing, as well as the difficulty people have in adapting to radical changes in the social structures and systems they live under.
And Kristen, I'm thinking even of that recent conversation where you talked about how democracy in the region that you write about has gone from a dream and an aspiration to kind of an insult and a kind of a dirty word in a way. So can you both talk about all of this and also the role of imagination and the imaginary in considering the potentials of people and political economic systems?
Well, I wanted to say something else, but now something came to my mind. I remember when I was in the midst of the work with Katarina, I was transitioning from my postdoc to Princeton, you know, in the early 2000s. So I arrived in Princeton, and I was contacted by an economist that I really greatly admire. And she wanted to recruit me to activities on campus. And she said, "What are you working on?" So I was telling stories. That's what we do best, right? I was telling stories, but stories are fantastic to tell because then you find maybe you find a storyline, maybe you stumble on your fantasy. You know, it's great. So I love that what we get out of the field, you know, are the stuff of storytelling. So I was telling some of the story of Katarina, and then fascinating was her response. Fascinating. But how representative is she? Right. How representative is she? And then I said, wow, I will take that question on. So how do I tackle that, you know, methodologically, right? So because I didn't want her to be further, you know, violated, you know, epistemically like that, of having no value because of her singularity and her story, right? So that now it was at the level of knowledge production. Mm-hmm. There's no theory can come out of this, or no understanding of larger socio-medical, political, economic processes can come out of this one life, right? That the anthropologist is trying to understand how it was made into a life not worth living or belonging, right? Or caring for. And I felt like one way that I could tackle that question was to come to reconstruct the moments in which there were crossroads in her existence, in which decisions were made, both institutionally, familially, right? And then try to understand, you know, the kind of ethics and politics on those registers of crossroads. You know, like what was happening with the medical system? What was happening in terms of policy for the mentally ill? What was happening in terms of labor in the little town where she was in, you know, and how decisions were made that she was not a viable employee, that she was not sound, medically, you know, mentally sound, or in the family that she was not worth caring for, and to try to reconstruct that, you know, to both institutionally, in terms of kinship ties, you know, in terms of economy. So, and in that way, to not make her only emblematic of something, but an opening to see how through one singular life, she was also the life of many, and what she her destiny was the destiny of many. And that was, so that was my way of tackling that. And in the process, I was able to see, you know, like a history of transition in Brazil as well. It was a democratic transition. Mm. It was a transition of mental health reform, becoming democratic, culture of rights. And then the policies or the infrastructure developments, they're very much at the level of models. One model policy here and there, right? And then basically the family ends up becoming the state, so to speak, that administers, that makes the decision who lives and who dies, and who does that mediated by the pharmacon, because that's how the state makes itself present in terms of healthcare. So I think there is something that by working with people, that kind of ethnography that we were speaking about, closely with people, we are able to understand larger socio-political economic processes, but also to recuperate political and ethical instances in which decisions were made and things could have gone one way or the other. But I also think the way the road not taken remains. It's latent and remained in Catarina. You know, she wanted to re-enter the world. So the subjunctive, what could have been, mm-hmm. is part of the condition that she also inhabited.
Yeah, I think that's exactly that. I mean, I felt the same way when I realized that I was writing about transition. I didn't really realize I was writing about transition. I was doing these interviews, and I sort of had a loose framework. And eventually, the common denominator was privatization, was the dismantling of the social safety net, was the rise of corruption, the rise of the mafia. The banking collapses, the fallout of hyperinflation, the fact that, you know, people who had desperately wanted to travel could now theoretically travel, but they didn't either have the money to travel or they couldn't get a visa to go abroad. Or the people who, you know, used to dream of having designer jeans or French perfumes, you know, now those things could be bought in a department store in Sofia, but nobody had the money because many people lost their jobs, lost their livelihoods. So again, I felt like what the stories did for me, and I have to say that I was in dialogue with quite a few economists in the late 90s and the early 2000s, and they kept reiterating that the sort of ethnographic material that I was presenting was outliers. Like, these were the so-called losers of transition that once capitalism and democracy sort of got up and running, everything would be fine and these people would be taken care of. This was just literally a transition. And it's been 30 years. right? And guess what? It's gotten worse. And now the economists, in fact, ironically, quite a few economists are now going to the ethnographic literature and saying, like, what did we do wrong? What were the anthologists telling us that we believed
early
were not representative?
Early warning systems, right? Ethnographic isn't early warning systems.
It's canary in the coal mine sort of stuff. Yeah, I think so. And so, and it's again, it's about using individual lives and stories and experiences to reflect on these wider social transformations that are happening. But also, I do think the latent possibility of what could have been different, you know, had the dreams been realized in a slightly different way. And imagination, I just wanted to jump on the last thing that you said, which is, I'm fascinated, as you know, by conspiracy theories. Because in this part, with the part of the world that I study, people have conspiracy theories to explain just about everything. And I think conspiracy theories take an incredible amount of imagination, right? To look at the world and, you know, and find a narrative that somehow explains how incredibly screwed up it is. So that you can attribute blame to somebody rather than just the amorphous global neoliberalism or capitalism or whatever those words are. Like, no, it's actually just like the Russian KGB that's behind it all or something like that. And to respect those narratives, to listen to those narratives. And again, as you said, it's almost like psychoanalysis. Like when people engage in conspiracy theorizing, what are they really doing? They're trying to assert control over a world in which they feel they have no control. They have no agency. And so they're narrating a dream of agency, a dream of being able to be in control of their lives. And that, to me, is just as important as people who are in control of their lives.
Yeah, and I think the challenge is, like, how do we remain sensitive to that? Those things are not archived.
No.
But the ethnographers have access to that somehow. Right, so the archives of power, right? They will not, you know, hold those things. But those things are passed on. Those things, they are felt. You know, they are effectively felt. They are passed on. You know, they can become shame. They can become like imagination of something else. They can become many things. And I think that's where ethnography, you know, has, you know, the as a kind of like a record of a different kind of archive. It's almost like a sensorium. Mm-hmm. Gets archived there, that still informs, you know, people from generation to generation can inform something. But the imagination question is fascinating too, because I think many times, exactly what you were saying, you know, people do have a sense of how things could be otherwise. And they try to carve that out, sometimes in very minute little ways, right? And how can we then also, as part of our work, you know, illuminate that, right, in some ways, because in many ways it has to be with how care could be done differently, right? What could be paid attention to, right? And many times, so I think it does something that provides us with materials that we, if we find intelligent ways, we can bring to attention to people who might be able to do something with that. But many times we are also shy to try to bring our materials to people, be it in the world of medicine or policy, right? Who could do something about that. Not that they would. Again, there's a potentiality there, right? Not that they would.
Unfortunately.
But I think there is something that somehow it also, I think we are timid with the stuff that we get.
Because of the representativeness question,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah.
But also, just you know, just one small anecdote. What you said, how you embody the imagination of an alternative reality. There was an informant in this Madan, this very small, very poor rural town, and she would dress to the nines every day. She was really very, very elegant. And it was like, you know, walking amongst the ruins of this post-industrial mining town. And I said, you know, I once asked her, like, you know, why do you dress up so much, right? It just seems so out of place. And she said, I dress for the life I want, not for the life I have. So every morning she wakes up and dreams of a different life. Yeah. And I thought that's a perfect example, right? Again, no archive of that.
Yeah.
She's just a well-dressed woman on the street, and you lose the meaning imbued in that act every day. Yeah.
Can I just jump on that? Like, one statement that got that Katharina wrote. She wrote this, what she called her dictionary. She wrote 21 volumes, like sea of words. And one expression, you know, that just always just enchanted me somehow was like, when men throw me in the air, I'm already far away. When men throw me in the air, I'm already far away. So there's something here, right? So here we see the man and his catapults, right, controlling some situation. And there's kind of like an orbit of sorts, like a directionality of sorts, but she's already far away. So it compounds our sense of space and time, right? But also the sense of presence and absence that people have the capacity to enter in and out. And I think sometimes, you know, our renderings of the subjects do not do justice to that in and out of the frame, even of the presence with us that our characters have.
Okay, so our last questions, again, touch upon themes that you've already spoken to, but and perhaps, Drow, this also provides an opportunity to talk more about Unfinished, since we've kind of pigeonholed you into talking about Katharina, when I know Unfinished is very much on your mind and very much kind of what you've been invested in the last months and years. But so, Drow, can you tell us more about what you mean by being attuned to unfinishedness, the unfinishedness of humans and of processes? Mm-hmm. What does it take to shift our orientations away from thinking about human beings and identities towards human becomings?
And also, what motivated you to write such a book in this political moment? And Kristen, also, can you speak about how your work engages some of these ideas about becomings and the unfinishedness of subjects?
I had told Aaron this afternoon that I think the best I could do would be to read an excerpt of the book, which I think, and then I would like to show you that image.
The
I Was Neil. Okay. So the book, Unfinished and the Power of Becoming, opens with this image, and I will read you the beginning so you get a little bit of a sense of how we're thinking about this. Alice Neal's 1965 oil painting, James Hunter Black Draftee, is an arresting portrait. Hunter's pensive face and supporting hand are richly filled in, while his ears and the rest of his body are only loosely sketched. The uncompleted image exposes how life worlds enter into the work of art. The artist had been inviting passersby on the New York City street into her studio to sit for her. Hunter, who said that he had been drafted to fight in the war in Vietnam, never returned for a second sitting. We don't know what happened to Hunter, but we know who wanted war and what war did, and how old and new wars make plain the transience and value of all things. Outlined by Neil in the spur of the moment, the seemingly invisible body of this fleeting subject is now a powerful reminder of the perennial struggle of minorities in the United States and elsewhere for full political recognition of their personhood. Hunter's detailed, expressive face also evokes his singularity and the concerns that weigh on him, while revealing little of who he is. Yet it is Hunter who punctuates the representation. So the painting seems unfinished, and this transfixing unfinishedness, the world's on the edge, and the open-endedness of people's becoming is the very stuff of art. With its receptiveness to and incorporation of the accidental and the unknown, Neil and Hunter's artwork, not possible without each other and the world's ongoingness, leaves us with a haunting, incomplete aesthetic and a challenge to further inquire into the multiplicity of life worlds and the plasticity of anthropological figures. So how can we ethnographically apprehend these worldly fabrications and the lives therein, constituted as they are by that which is unresolved, and bring this unfinishedness into our storytelling? How are long-standing theoretical approaches able or not to illuminate emergent political, economic, and affective realities? How can the becomings of our informants and collaborators and the movements and counter-movements they fashion serve as alternative figures of thought that might animate comparative work, political critique, and anthropology to come? ethnographic creations, as we think of in this book, are about the plasticity and unfinishedness of human subjects and life worlds. And the essays, and we play with the essaying here, are themselves unfinished views of people, including anthropologists, scientists, and artists, in the process of becoming through things, relations, stories, survival, destruction, and reinvention in the borrowed time of an invisible present. The notion of becoming, which organizes the individual and collective efforts of this book, emphasizes the plastic power of people and the intricate problematics of how to live alongside, through, and despite the profoundly constraining effects of social, structural, and material forces, which are themselves plastic. Unfinishedness is both precondition and product of becoming, and we chose the title Unfinished as a way of drawing attention to this important feature in all of the book's ethnographic characters and inquiries, its attempts at open thinking and experimental writing, because it's the other challenge. But depending on the kind of works, the surrendering we allow to the ethnographic, it will produce stuff that will require different modes of writing. And these are openings for us, right? So unfinishedness, as we see it, is a feature as generative to art and knowledge production as it is to living, right? And in some ways, it's an attempt to move beyond, you know, deterministic analytics of the human subject, in terms of history, the unconscious, or even power, right? Think of power more dynamically, right? Much more dynamically. Many times power comes afterwards, right? But also to think more dynamically about the figuring and disfiguring and refiguring of the human without, you know, falling into naive, you know, boundedness of ethnos or, you know, or essentialisms of humanity, of the human. But still, it seems to us the unfinishedness accounts for the kind of figure and refiguring of the human that we see anthropology as generative of. Somehow, our definition of the unfinished is quite expensive, right? Our ethnographic work always begins in the midst of social life. So it already begins in the middle of something, its rhythms, affects, surprises, from the trivial to the tragic. And the categories and books we bring to the field are also unfinished, right? Somehow the field, the ethnographic, destabilizes the book, so to speak, the uppercase book or uppercase T of theory, right? So there's an unfinishedness built in the very analytical work that we are after. But we also know that people are unfinished, you know, in both in their meaning making, but also in their desire. They're looking for aggregates, you know, of relationships to things, to others, you know, to context, to landscapes, right? So, and becoming in this way, you know, troubles and exceeds our way of knowing and acting somehow. It pushes us to think against the grain, and it also opens us up to a sense of improvisation, both, you know, existentially, but also, you know, in this case, analytically. So I will stop there. So that's a little sample of the beginning of the book, and we were fortunate to work with an incredible cast, you know, including your own Adriana Petrina, our own Adriana Petrina, Angela Garcia, Lawrence Ralph, Nizar Jidave, Lily Schwartz, Lucas Basir, Elizabeth David, Peter Locke, and the co-editor of the book, and Mike Fisher. So just want to name them, so to evoke their presence here.
Yeah, and you know, I'll just add to say that for me, you know, I think a lot of my work has been inflected by the sort of possibilities of becoming, or of not becoming. Usually it's not becoming. It's wanting to become, but not being able to become. And the way that I've dealt with that is that I've taken the next step, which is the art, the short stories and fiction. I was very fortunate to serve as the president of the Society for Humanistic Anthropology, which actually has ethnographic fiction category, and publishes Anthropology and Humanism publishes ethnographic fiction. So there's a small home for this kind of work within the field. And I felt that some of the interior narratives that I had access to indirectly, people telling me stories or people narrating a memory or a thought or a dream, they were hard They got flattened when I just described them ethnographically. And so it was much easier to sort of take that kernel and develop it into a story. So in both Lost in Transition and in the new book, Red Hangover, there are several short pieces of fiction that play precisely with the desire to be more than one can be, or the attempt to be and then the failure to be. So I think it's a really wonderful place. It's a really generative frame of mind, but sometimes it pushes you outside the boundaries of what I would call genre normative ethnography into places that are, you know, sort of like seldom ventured. and that's where I find myself being most sort of able and free and able to play with that idea of unfinishedness and plasticity.
That's a good transition, right, for us to show the film, do you think?
Yeah, so Joao's going to talk a little bit about Gary Hurst's work that we're going to then screen.
Yeah.
And then after, if you still have time to spend with us, we'd love to open up to a more public and kind of inclusive conversation.
Okay. So there are three short pieces, and it's wonderful the way you described this. And like, I was lucky to be contacted 2 years ago by a South African British artist, Gary Hurst, who had read Vita and fell in love with Katarina. And he said that he wanted to do artwork based on her writing, her thinking. And so he started to do drawings, but he also wanted to do a play. So he contacted a French actress who translated whatever was of Katarina's dictionary in Vita into French. And he's a multimedia artist, so you will see the first short film is about less than 2 minutes. It's supposed to be three screens. He would project these three, but he just compressed them to appear as three screens in one screen. And so you will see Elsa translating Katarina that I had already translated into English into French, mixed with some of the initial drawings that he did. The second piece is 3 minutes where he really went into the literality of Katarina. Whatever it's in the book, whatever he got from the ethnographer, including the chemical, the drugs that she was taking and decomposing the chemical products and doing art out of that. Almost creating a certain, let's say, a literal unconscious of Katarina, so to speak. That's the second film, about 3 minutes, with other images that he worked with and reworked and ripped up photos. He's trying to deconstruct the very idea of the image of Katarina, you know. And then the third part is, it's a short film, about 8 minutes, but it's magical to me because he came to see me twice in Princeton last year in October and just a few weeks ago. And when he came to Princeton, I unearthed the dictionaries, the 21, and also the tapes, the conversations. Remember, I said I was plugged in. And he was out of his mind when he started to touch physically the dictionary. And he had a Brazilian read. And something magical happened. Sound, the sound of Katarina's words. Something that I had not paid attention to. I was concerned with finding literality there and connections. And by having Andrea read in the words in Portuguese, a whole new sensorial dimension of her writing emerged, right, that I had not known or partaken in. So the third film is this reading, the sound, the joy. There's some, you know, some English, but some is in Portuguese as well. So, but it also has, you will see at some moment, Katarina's voice comes into the film.